Hi, Katie.
Hi, Brian.
Did you have a nice Thanksgiving?
I had a lovely Thanksgiving. You know why?
Why?
I didn't cook a damn thing. We went to a restaurant and ate everything from soup to nuts. How lazy am I? How was your Thanksgiving, Brian?
It was very good. You know, my family cooked, so the turkey was dry, but the pie was good.
Same old, same old.
Same old.
I've never had
a
moist turkey, actually.
No, I mean, I think we should have like a Thanksgiving ham or something instead.
I'd like a Thanksgiving rib roast
myself.
Oh,
that's a good idea, like a prime rib for Thanksgiving. That'd be a lot better.
Anyway, but it is an opportunity to kind of have a little time off and to give thanks in all sincerity for our blessings. And that obviously means our family, our friends, our good fortune, and you, Brian, and this podcast.
That's
true. Today I'm exceptionally thankful that I get to talk to Hugh Jackman, Matt Bai, and Jay Carson. Did they sound like afterthoughts? Well, maybe because
there's
they kind
a long
of were.
Pause after Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman, of course, has a new movie out called The Front Runner, all about Gary Hart's ill-fated campaign and what happened to him in 3 weeks back in 1987 when it looked like he was going to win his party's nomination for president of the United States. But it was when everything changed, not only for Gary Hart, but for the media and for our country.
And we should provide a little bit of background. Gary Hart was a Democratic senator from Colorado. He had run unsuccessfully for president once before. Everybody sort of assumed he was going to be the leader of the pack in 1988. But then the media started digging around his personal life, and that was kind of the beginning of the end for his effort.
I can assure you, Senator, this is relevant.
It's just that we saw you leave and come back with this woman, and we didn't see her.
Tom, you can't be serious. No one is staying in my home. There's no need for that, all right?
I am serious, sir. How long have you known this woman?
What kind of questions are these?
Is she a friend?
Well, I don't know why I would tell you that, Tom. I am not going to...
Can you produce her to corroborate what you're saying
here? I don't
have
to produce anything. This has gone on long enough.
Senator, we know you've made calls to this woman from Kansas and New Hampshire.
Well, I make calls every day. I don't see how I'd remember.
But Senator,
and I don't...
was that your announcement speech? Okay, you said we must hold ourselves accountable to the highest possible standards of integrity and ethics. Then why are we standing here?
Now, Hugh Jackman did not do this on his own. It's based on a book written by Matt Bai, one of our favorites. We worked together when we were both at Yahoo News. Matt is still there as the national political columnist. So this movie is based on his book called All the Truth Is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. We're also joined by another one of my favorites, Jay Carson.
Jay Carson helped adapt Matt's book into the screenplay, along with director Jason Reitman. Jay's had a pretty interesting career himself. He's currently a senior advisor at Bloomberg Philanthropies. He's worked on a lot of big political campaigns. You and I think, first got to know him 10 years ago when he was the traveling press secretary for Hillary Clinton.
That's right. Fun fact, Ryan Gosling played the character based on Jay in the 2013 movie The Ides of March. As I'm looking at you, Brian, Ryan Gosling could play you in the movie all about our podcast.
You know, if I had a nickel for every time somebody said that to me, Katie, I'm confused for Hugh or for Ryan, particularly when I'm in a short sleeve shirt.
Anyway, we decided we were going to have a long conversation with them about politics, the media, about Gary Hart, and how you really take a story that happened in 1987 and make it relevant today. So we started out by asking Matt why he wanted to write a book about this chapter in American politics in the first place.
There are just stories. I know you've had this experience, Katie. There are just stories that grab you. They don't really let you go. I'm not a person who has a million ideas I want to live with for a long time. In fact, this might be the only one. But, you know, I had met Gary Hart at the end of 2002 when I was at the New York Times Magazine. I'd written about him. I'd been found myself really compelled both by him and his story and also about the things I'd missed about his story. I mean, the more I looked into it, the more I found that some things were just so misremembered about it, even things I'd repeated, honestly, that just weren't right. And I think to myself, as a journalist, if we've just put something in a box and we've collectively misremembered it, why? You know, why do you do that? You don't do that for no reason. You overlook something for a reason. And I really began to look into it, decided I wanted to do the book, which really people did think was a crazy idea, except for Jay, my wife, you know, people. But, you know, by you know, the book came out in 2014. And, you know, I should mention, because we started talking about all of us behind the movie, but, you know, the driving force behind the movie is Jason Reitman, our director and co-writer, who, you know, who heard me talking about the book on a podcast and on a Radiolab piece and just was immediately got it, you know, just was hooked. Read the book immediately, you know, if you know Jason, just like read the book in about 20 seconds, mm-hmm. You know, had the movie in his head by the time we all sat down and we all just had this kind of magical collaboration, really.
And what was it, Hugh, that made you think, gosh, I want to play Gary Hart?
Well, Jason was a big part of it, and I didn't know a lot about the story, and I was amazed when I read it of how this incredible, for me, incredible candidate with unbelievably strong ideas somehow quit politics forever. Like, this was the guy who was definitely going to be the next president. 3 weeks later, he's out forever. And this sort of mix about principles and ethics and public versus private, there was so much about it that fascinated me. And I was in probably 20 pages into the script. I thought the writing was so smart. I loved being part of a movie that wasn't heroes and villains. It was just a whole bunch of characters. I loved the way the women were portrayed in the movie, and it really made me think, which ultimately is a great thing if you're going to see a movie. And if you're going to be in a movie and you're going to dedicate 6-9 months of your life, you want it to be something that's really going to grab you, you know?
Jay, there were very few negatives on Hart, but one was this sort of undefined sense that he was a little bit flaky. He had changed his last name. He had changed his signature. He'd even changed his birth date at one point. But the other was Hart's reputation as a womanizer. And of course, before 1988, reporters didn't look at the private lives of candidates pretty much ever. Why do you think this changed? Why do you think the Hart campaign was the moment that this shifted?
I mean, there's a confluence of events that happen around 88 that lead to this moment shifting, and it shifts and it never returns. But there is a rule pre-88, which is that someone's personal life is never relevant. The rule post-88 is that it's always relevant. Mm-hmm. What we're arguing for in this movie is some judgment on the part on all of our parts, the voters, the journalists, the candidates. Certainly there were times pre-88 where it was relevant. We should have known what was going on behind closed doors. Certainly there have been times post-88 where we don't need to know. And that's sort of – we're trying to start that conversation because I think that absolute rules, whether they are ideology or something like always and never, are they're just lazy on all of our parts.
So what was it about the atmosphere though then and the environment, Matt, that – this confluence that Jay referred to, that was it increased competition? Was it, you know, the Us mm-hmm. Weeklies of the world coming into play? I mean, you know, I remember because I'd worked at WTVJ in Miami and I was a big admirer of Tom Fiedler's. But
the Miami Herald.
Yeah, he's from the Miami Herald that was really involved in breaking the story, mm-hmm. right? What was happening that caused this?
There are moments in time where things come together in a way that changes. And it's not just politics, it changes the culture. And I think, you know, in retrospect, what's easier to see now than at that moment in the mid-1980s, you had a bunch of things going on. You're about a decade after Watergate, which changes journalism in a couple of profound ways. It changes, yes, in a sort of base career ambition way, right? If you can take down a politician now, you can get rich and famous. But also, it quite rightly, I think, puts the focus on moral character of our leaders more than it had been, and because it was embarrassing for the media to have missed that about Richard Nixon. You had the rise of feminism on the left, which changed attitudes about adultery. You had the rise of the moral majority on the right, which also put personal behavior much more in the realm of political discussion. And then you have the birth of, you know better than I do, the birth of satellite television, right? CNN launches in the early 1980s, flyaway satellite dishes are
1980,
new.
Exactly.
Right. Suddenly you have this moment where you can broadcast live anything from anywhere, and you've got to keep people in their seats. And the definition of news changes when it's an hour-to-hour sort of keep the ratings up issue. And so all of these things come together, I think, in that moment. And as a result, what happens in 1987 is that we begin from that moment to treat our candidates much more like we treat our celebrities. And I would submit that when you treat politicians like celebrities and create a process that demands celebrity, you will get celebrities as politicians and wanting to enter the process. And I think that's been the direct line that you can follow from that moment to the one in which we find ourselves, frankly, more relevant than we thought writing the script. We had the script done before the 2016 election, but I think events have just made it so unsettlingly timely in some ways.
You know, so, I think you accomplished something that I thought was impossible. You made Hugh Jackman actually unappealing.
Yeah. It's actually not that difficult. You'd be surprised.
No, we clearly haven't spent enough time together.
One thing that struck me, you know, because I remember Gary Hart. I think I've interviewed him on a number of occasions. And, of course, I remember the story well, even though I was in local news mm-hmm. when this story happened. You know, I kept thinking, God, he's so humorless. And he's so lacking in charisma. He's so obnoxiously earnest. That's what I thought when really? I watched this movie. Did you set out to make him that way?
I think it was just Hugh coming through.
How did you tap into that,
This
Hugh?
Is because the least amount of acting I've ever done.
He is the I know you. He is the antithesis of everything you are. I mean, did you just have to, like, try to sublimate any personality?
No, I have a different perspective from meeting him and spending time with him. I find him very mercurial in a way. Like, I actually jokingly said to him, have you ever thought about being an actor? Because when I'm around a lot of actors, I always feel like any adjective could work with that actor. Like, actors have to chop and change so much that they can at times be grumpy or earnest or funny. And I've found him, maybe because of everything I'd heard or read, I was surprisingly warm, funny, very inviting, very, very hospitable. He was quite serious and brief in what he did. And people were, even his own campaign team at important moments, were on eggshells at times around him because he was very serious and he wasn't, you know, mucking around. But my job was to bring you close enough, but never let you in. That's what I felt. And Jason and I talked about that a lot because he is a very private person. And a lot of people I spoke to, even to this day, once you spend years around him, like, couldn't quite grab onto who he is. So I'm a little, even hearing you now, I'm like, maybe I didn't quite work. I was hoping for a bit like, I think I've got it, but I'm not sure. Like that.
I felt that way.
It works.
Thank you, bro.
I felt like he was almost contemptuous of the People magazine culture we were moving toward.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, literally. Oh, definitely.
I think it's
was.
A discomfort just, more than anything. I think that's what Hugh brings across so brilliantly. I do think Hugh is absolutely brilliant in this film. I think we all do. And part of it is telegraphing something that's very hard to telegraph with your face, with your emotions, is this discomfort with the arena. This not being able to feel yourself, with feeling always under a microscope and feeling the ground shifting underneath you and not being able to adapt to it. It's a hard thing to get across with somebody who doesn't deliver long soliloquies, which is Jay and I
and
Jason really wanted to
stay away
from.
And I think you did a great job. Don't get me wrong. I just didn't find Gary Hart very appealing for me, because I think he was so intent upon maintaining this zone of privacy as somebody who watched the movie, I just wanted to mess up his hair and slap him around and get him drunk.
Right. Well, by the way, he got me drunk. He makes a mean martini when I stayed at his house. Oh, yeah. No, he can he can throw him back. But it's interesting because I think ideas were so important to him and he spent hours on them. And so when he was doing a speech on economics or on anything, it had been years of working things out. Before he ran, he had been to every country, met with not just the leader, but the opposition leader. So he knew, like, his detail on how he could possibly lead the country very well over an 8-year period was incredible.
Did he have enough EQ for this current environment and for mass media? And, you know, when they say people vote for the guy or gal they want to have a beer with, he just didn't seem to have any of those, hey, let's hang out qualities.
I know what you mean. And I think I find myself in the same place, sometimes scolding myself for needing the person to have the right EQ. And I have, through the process of writing and doing this movie, wanted to flip that around in my head and wonder why we put so much stress on that, right? We're watching someone who's clearly brilliant, who's clearly thought the job through, but we don't like them enough. And it's this weird thing where, like, we would never treat our airline pilot that way. I mean, I flew through a lot of turbulence to get here last night, and I wasn't thinking as I was laying there trying to sleep through the bouncing around, like, do I like my pilot? Is he nice enough? I'm like, I want him to be able to fly the goddamn plane right. and land it.
That's true.
And we flipped it around with President, which is much more serious than flying just 200 of us across the country.
Why did that happen?
I personally want a pilot who chats.
He can get on Southwest and they do both, right? They're funny and they can fly, but like, I'll take flying over funny and likable every day, but I do it too. Like, I would pick candidates I would work for based on, do I like them? Do I want to be around them all the time? That's not the right prioritization.
Don't they have to be great communicators, though? Isn't that part of Donald Trump's problem, is that he just doesn't know how to heal the nation in times of duress? He doesn't know how to inspire anyone. All he knows is how to, you know, hate on people, really. And to me, communicating and setting a tone is as important as having the cerebral qualities of coming up with the best policies.
But let me just add another little thing into that mix, in that there's a great documentary about his 84 run, and he's on camera saying, I'm often called cool and aloof, but when we win that first primary, everyone will call me enigmatic. And and that's exactly what happened. So he wins in a landslide. Everyone's like, who's this guy out of nowhere and heart and da-da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, people see him in this different prism. So if we cut to 1987, let's say he wins the first four or five primaries, he's 20 points ahead of Bush, people are seeing him in a whole different light. He probably carries himself in a different light. He doesn't have to work so, like, it might have fit perfectly with his character, and we would have just gone, ah, I love this guy. He's so great. He doesn't have to talk on and on. Like, I think it's just interesting. He did have an understanding of human nature, and maybe it was events as much as anything.
Well, and front runners are covered differently. Hart was supposed by everyone to be the next president of the United States, and so he generated a lot of extra scrutiny.
Right.
But I want to ask you about how much the rules actually changed, because after Hart, Bill Clinton and, frankly, our current president have gotten away with extramarital affairs.
Right.
Why do you think they were able to get through these controversies, but Hart wasn't?
Does Hart get away?
I mean, Brian, it's exactly what I was saying. This is what I was saying a moment ago, because you create a process that rewards a certain amount of shamelessness and evasion and the willingness to drag your family in front of the cameras and frankly, to be dishonest. And, you know, I mean, you can look at it and say, well, Bill Clinton survived. Now I look at Donald Trump and he's got all this checkered stuff and he just says whatever he wants and sails through. Okay, but I would look at it, I would suggest that it's very different, which is you've created a process that rewards an entirely different set of qualities. What we think of as leadership now is not what we thought of as leadership prior to 1987. It's not about ideas. It's not about intellect. It's not about even a certain amount of reserve, which people generally expected in their leaders. It's now about How well can you evade the traps? How well can you emote on cue? How much are you willing to share? How much can you humanize yourself? And how can you lie effectively to get around the things about yourself that would be morally damaging? I think when you change the definition of what makes a great candidate, you get the candidates who meet those qualifications.
Well, Obama was a pretty good candidate, but I don't know that he fit all of those criteria.
Well, it ends up being incidental. You know, you may have someone who knows how to do the job, but it's their performing ability that we're looking at first. It's just what I was saying. It's not can they fly the plane. It's their performance ability, and incidentally, they may have gone to flight school, but we're not really asking those questions first. We have a process that rewards shamelessness.
Is it because there's no marketplace of ideas? I mean, is it because of our modern media culture that emphasizes sort of the quick, dramatic, theatrical aspect of a candidate or a president? I mean, why did it all change? I mean, are we just stupid? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think that's a chicken and egg question, right? Does the process dumb down the dialogue and bleed it of ideas, or does a lack of ideas create a more vapid process? And that's part of the conversation I think people can debate, you know, when they think about these issues. To your point, Brian, about President Obama, which is a very interesting case, and I think very actually quite similar to Senator Hart in some ways in terms of personality. I would actually argue that while President Obama is different than the other people we talked about, his mere existence as a candidate and a president would not have been possible in a process that were not dominated by a kind of entertainment narrative. He was the star of a drama. You know, we call him No Drama Obama. The truth is, he had very little experience, very little qualification, had thought through very little about governing the country, but he was a story. There was a great story arc and a great character to what he sold the country. And I know him, and I don't argue he wasn't a good president. I'm simply saying he is part and parcel of an era where entertainment has become intertwined and inseparable from politics. And I think this, what we're looking at here, is a genesis moment. It's a moment, you know, what we're trying to show people is a moment where it shifted so they can leave and reflect and argue about how it got here, whether it should have been different, and where the responsibility lies.
On the other hand, I was frustrated because, Jay, I kept thinking, why couldn't Gary Hart just keep it in his pants? What the hell was wrong with him?
I mean, look, I mean,
is it too much to expect? Maybe I'm just not idealistic and naive. But I kind of want my president to be faithful. Is that weird?
Well, Matt, you once noted that Teddy White said that of all the candidates he covered in half a century for president, only three, Harry Truman, George Romney, and Jimmy Carter, had not enjoyed the pleasure of, quote, casual partners, which is kind of unbelievable.
We could have, I guess we could have 20 Carter administrations if that's what you want, but,
Should I not care?
I mean, I think that, you know, part of what we're arguing in this movie is that, like, it's okay for you to care. There, you and a big block of voters do care, and that's just fine. It's not, it.
And we're not arguing to go backward, right?
No. But everyone may not care. But it's absolutely, if that's
they didn't care about Bill Clinton, and suddenly now they care again because of Monica Lewinsky.
But I mean, to bring it back to the movie, the Clinton case is an interesting one because it goes back to what we were talking about. There's the performative skills and the willingness to do anything to get through a scandal leads to 1992. You know, he takes a number of steps that Gary Hart wasn't willing to take in 88. You know, if you'll the 60 Minutes interview to start, right? You know, I mean, Hart was like, I am not going to force my wife to sit next to me and do an interview about this. I'm just not going to do it.
We didn't even take her on stage
and
for
other
a news conference.
You know, other candidates.
Well, they also seemed to have a super weird relationship to me.
I got to say, first of all, the assumption that all that happened with Gary is not a given.
Well,
that's
they both
not,
deny it, actually, 100%, Donna Rice and Gary Hart.
100%. And he has been on record to saying they had two separations, two, maybe three, during. Mm-hmm. They just celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary, and I stayed with them at their house. And Gary, she was recovering from elective hip surgery, and Gary, at 6 o'clock in the morning, we had the tray with the folded napkin and her pills for the thing and taking the breakfast to her. And I saw nothing but love and devotion and family. And come on, you're 60 years. It's not going to be all rose. But the point of the movie is not did he or didn't he, even if he did, is that disqualifying? But I just feel I'm sitting here going, I have to stand up for Gary, like, because I know if Gary was here, we're like, well, hang on a sec, stop assuming that I'm one of those presidents, but, you know, who, or presidential candidates who did or didn't.
We're talking to Hugh Jackman, Jay Carson, and Matt Bai about their movie The Front Runner. We'll be back with more right after this quick break.
Now back to Hugh Jackman, Jay Carson, and Matt Bai.
Hugh, there's a famous moment that's covered in the film when your character is asked by a reporter, who's E.J. Dion in real life, about his womanizing reputation.
For God's sake, E.J., just ask whatever it is you came here to ask or whatever your editor told you to ask me. This is beneath you.
Okay. Do you feel like you have a traditional marriage?
Yeah, nope, that's it.
You know, you want to know what I'm doing in my spare time, AJ? Is that it? Follow me around. Put a tail on me. You'd be very bored.
A couple of points on that. Hart didn't think anybody would actually do it. And the Miami Herald reporters were already following
him around.
Hart, they used that post facto as a justification.
Yeah, I think Matt's book for Gary, one great takeaway for him was that finally, I mean, for what, probably the smartest politician that may have ever been in America, one of the smartest, to be known as doing the dumbest thing, well, I think to him was one of those great injustices, as Matt's book put that, you know, to rights, that it was a throwaway comment. And yeah, and they were already following him around, you know. But I encourage people to, okay, so view the movie and this whole 3 weeks – from the idea that he did it, right? Okay, so he did it, and how, and then view it from the prism that maybe there was nothing with Donna Wright. Maybe nothing, but he meant maybe. There's this whole story in The Atlantic that Lee Atwater had set the whole thing up. And okay, take that as a, and view it from that prism, and then watch a man who did
but
not.
But buy a ticket every time, right?
What's that?
But buy a ticket every time. If you.
But by the way, you just mentioned that as kind of an aside. That Jim Fallows piece in The Atlantic was pretty fascinating.
Fascinating.
I mean, Matt, I'm curious your view on this since you're the world's expert. Basically, Fallows spoke to a very famous media guy, Ray Strother, who worked for Hart, right, who had like a deathbed conversation with Lee Atwater, George Bush's strategist, who told him that the monkey business, the images, the whole thing was sort of set up by Bush's campaign. Do you buy that?
I don't know, Brian. I mean, I'm like you. I find it fascinating. I think here's what I know. I think it's perfectly plausible that the Republicans would have set out to do Hardin at that point. I also think that so many decisions were made by people who I know were not part of a plot that week that, you know, I don't think you could construct a Rube Goldberg machine quite that intricate, right? People use judgment and bad judgment often. And so I think it's possible both things were going on. I don't think you could, any conspiracy could account for all the things that happened that week or how it unfolded. But ultimately for us, you know, it's just interesting. I mean, we're more interested in the forces that set it all in motion and how it changed the industry. I mean, regardless of what set that in motion. So I'm fascinated. I've talked to Jim Fallows about it, and I've given him new paths to go down, and I hope he keeps looking at it because I think it's a fun thing to speculate about, but I it is just really speculative.
And relevance. If it happened, is it still, is that, like maybe for you that is, that disqualifies someone as a candidate? But
I don't know. I don't know if it does or not, honestly. I think sometimes it's the reaction to it that if he had said, and I don't know if we can go back to 1987 and say, well, what should he have done? What could he have done? Could he have somehow gotten out of this for the good of the country to push forward his ideas?
But that's the fun of it, right?
I know. And watching it, I was like,
If Gary was only interested in political survival, I have no doubt he could have got out of that.
In a second.
What would he have done, Hugh, to get out of it?
You know,
For starters.
I've been on record. You know, my wife and I have been married for 30 years. We've had two or three separations, but we're together. We're working on it. And like any couple, we're committed to doing our best. Anyway, can we move on to economic? Because that's what I'm saying. If you view it from the prison, let's say nothing happened, right, with that situation. And then you've got a man whose principle is, first thing is, I'm going to protect my wife and children. So every time I get asked a question, my now grown-up children are listening to this about their mom and dad. My wife is hearing me talk about this, right? And he was against that. That's a betrayal to them. And it's not my right to just talk about our private life, as well as the political process. Like every time I answer that question, every time I answer the question boxes or briefs or what's my dog's name, I am draining down the IQ of the political process. So he refused to do it. So let's say he's innocent. He can save himself politically, but he opts, you know what, I'm not. That's not a question I'm going to answer. Then he becomes almost like a martyr, you know? So that's what I find is interesting about this process, you know?
Well, I think
everyone just views it from the perspective of personal survival and how he could have saved himself, but he may have had more at stake.
I guess, but he really fell on his sword, right? And Donna Rice was just sort of, you know, just one instance. And I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but weren't there a lot of other dalliances?
Well, he'd been, as you know, separated twice for long periods of time. So it's hard to,
presidential candidates, do not hang out with Warren Beatty. Hashtag just saying.
They're still close friends. In the film, you know, you see, the evidence of another dalliance. But since you raised Donna Rice, can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, please.
That was really, really important to us both. In Donna Rice, you know, somebody who went through this kind of modern scandal as the other woman for the first time, really gets reduced to a punchline, is just as defined by this and made just as two-dimensional as Hart was. And then, you know, expanding that to all the other women you see in the film, you know, it was very important to us. You know, obviously I talked to Donna a lot for the book. This is very important for us to make sure that that perspective was not just expressed, not like in a token way, but actually like that we had three-dimensional characters, that Donna Rice was shown to be a very real human being with potential and emotions, and she's bright and she's principled. And, you know, we worked very hard. Helen Estabrook, our producer, you know, everyone writing the script, we're guys, obviously. And Helen, our producer, who was so brilliant and kept, you know, with every draft, you know, pushing us on, you know, what was complicated enough, what was important to understand about a woman's perspective, how women in these situations get burdened with speaking for their entire gender, you know, have to stand in. We really worked hard at it. And I think it's one of the things we're all really proud of, and the performances that women in the film gives, Sarah Paxton, your chief among them. I just think it's, and Vera Farmiga, of course, is amazing.
She was great.
She brings you to tears. And I just think that's an aspect of the film we've worked very hard on and we're very, very proud of.
I really like the line by the Washington Post? Mm. I couldn't quite figure out. She had a big job at the Post.
Anna Broy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be Anna Broy.
Gary Grainer plays her in the
and
film.
And she said a line about power.
He's a man.
A man with power has opportunity
and takes a certain amount of responsibility.
For me, that line really resonated, because as I wrestled myself watching this, like, does it matter? Should it matter? I felt like she was channeling the Me Too movement.
And this is pre-Me Too.
Back in 1987.
We wrote it before that.
Yeah,
I love the moment when the Donna Rice character says to the female heart aide, I've worked my entire life so that people like you wouldn't look at a person like me the way you are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very powerful.
We tried to show everyone in this as three-dimensional human beings, the journalists, the women, the candidates, the voters, you know, and show their struggle and their pain as they go through this, you know, crazy process that no one had ever faced before.
Yeah, you guys, I know, want this to be relevant and you want this to spur conversation. I mean, what do you hope that are some of the issues that people will be grappling with long after they leave this movie, in terms of the role of the press and the responsibility of our leaders and the climate and what we need to care about, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, what are you hoping people will think about?
Certainly all of these questions. And I hats off to both of you guys and Jason. It's a script really without answers. And it would have been easy to give answers. You guys know that world inside and out. It would have been easy to give that, but you don't. And in the end, for what that does for me, and I hope perhaps it does for everyone else, is what's my personal responsibility? Now, I'm actually Australian, but of course,
you still bear responsibility.
It's my fault. But we do, like, in our choices of how we consume news, of how we vote, are we, what is our civic duty? Rather, you know, how are we participating in the process? What is important to me? Have I really thought this through? Do I actually know I know about the boat and the girl. What were Gary Hart's policies again? Like, you know what I mean? Like, when we pick up our phone and we all have the phone, it gives us four stories, right? The moment you wake up, and two of them, one is Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson. And like, do we click on that one? Like, you know, what are we actively working out what is important over what is entertaining or interesting? And I think that's the question I hope people end up grappling with.
You know? What about you guys?
Well said. No, that's really well said from my perspective. I mean, we deliberately made a film that we hope gets people thinking and debating among themselves. We hope, and it's been our experience, that people walk out of the theater actually having an argument about it, because we don't have the answers. As Jason always says, and it really resonates with me as a journalist, because it's always been my journalistic impulse as well. He starts a story with a question that he wants to ask, not with an answer. And this is not a film that gives you answers. If you're looking for them, you might be disappointed. I think this is a film that shows you a moment that you may not have known existed, where it set us on a path. And asks everybody involved, including you sitting there watching it, to reflect on what the consequences of those decisions are and whether you would have made the same decisions. And I think it's a very personal experience, I think, watching it.
Jay?
We could use a little less relevance with this movie,
really,
honestly.
Good, yeah.
We started writing it, like, you know, during the Obama administration, and all of a sudden it felt like the world was catching up to the movie in terms of 2016 election and Me Too. And it's really a question of what's relevant and what's important. And the movie actually asks that of you from the first shot to the last. In that first 2.5 minute oneer, which is our Hollywood speak for, it's just a single shot uncut. You're tracking through different conversations. You're trying to figure out what's going on. And you're trying to, do I want to listen to the guys talk about how to jumpstart a golf cart? Or do I want to watch this? Do I want to watch Walter Mondale on TV? Do I want to watch Gary Hart? You're trying to catch up to the last scene where you have a marriage trying to hold on the left side of the screen and Gary Hart giving a speech on the right side. And we were just literally asking the audience for the entire time to grapple with what's relevant and what's important.
Well, it's really timely, despite the fact everything happened in 1987. I can't think of a better dream team to bring this story to life than you three. Really, three of my favorite people all around a table, and you too, Brian.
Thank you, Katie.
No, really, thanks for coming in, and really appreciate it.
Thank
and
you guys.
Love to see you all. The Front Runner, starring Hugh Jackman, is in theaters now, and that's all we got for you today.
The crack team that made this show is producer Emma Morgenstern, associate producer Nora Ritchie, and audio engineer Jared O'Connell.
And as always, a big thank you to Julia Lewis, who helps with my social media, Jim Brown, who helps us book guests, and Beth DeMoss, my assistant.
Jared Arnold composed our theme music. You can find me on Twitter under @GoldsmithB, and Katie is breaking the internet every day while keeping her clothes on. On Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as what else, Katie Couric?
Well, most days I'm keeping my clothes on. If you have thoughts about the show or questions for us, please reach out. Our email address is comments@couricpodcast.com, or you can leave us a voicemail by calling 929-224-4637. As always, thanks so much for listening. We so appreciate your support, and we'll see you next week.